I think we have to focus on the gospel reading for today. Not that there isn't lots that I couldn't be talking about with regards to our reading from Exodus or Corinthians, including the very first line of the first Corinthians for the message about the cross. Well, actually, it's a different word in the Greek. It could be of, or for, or because of, or about. Anyway, I'm not going to go there. I just got quite excited when I read it and decided that my geeking with the Greek wouldn't go for today, because there's so much within this passage from the second chapter of St. John's Gospel. This passage is commonly called the cleansing of the temple. And there are so many, frankly, dangerous interpretations of it that we really have to consider this one with some care. What do I mean by dangerous, you say? Well, for many interpreters over the centuries, this passage has been used to justify an unrestrained anger, often under the label of righteous anger, which has led to violence in the form of, for instance, attacks on abortion clinics, the Crusades, Bernard of Clairvaux used it there, the burning of heretics, as John Calvin used it, something called just war theory, the beating of those who hold different theological opinions, often by bishops. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that detail. Although St. Nicholas, who we often call Santa Claus, was famous for punching a heretic on the floor of a synod. And it's been used too for the condemnation of both non-Christians and those of other faiths, and so much more that has been unhelpful in the life of the church. But this story, which is found in all four of the canonical Gospels, is though not a justification for nor an invitation to anger that leads to violence. It's here for very specific reasons, none of which involve seeking to emulate a Jesus who is beside himself with anger and who turns with a whip to beat out the money changers and sellers of animals, as on the artwork on the front cover of today's bulletin. First of all, it's important to note that John's account, as always, is slightly different to the other three Gospels. John's account is the only one that mentions a whip of cords, and that whip, the text is clear, is used to drive the sheep and cattle from the marketplace. To quote verse 15 of chapter 2, making a whip of cords, he drove all of them out of the temple, both the sheep and the cattle. That's the correct Greek grammar. No gospel account records any violence against any of the people in the story, no matter what the classical paintings may all show of terrified widows and angry traders. Secondly, and this is really important to me, there is no indication in any of the Gospels how Jesus is feeling. It doesn't mention that he's angry, righteous or otherwise. He may indeed have been angry, and his words are a strong rebuke to the traders and the money changers in all of the Gospel accounts. But there is not even a hint of unrestrained or uncontrolled anger, or of the kind of brutality that goes with that out-of-control anger. Interestingly, John's Gospel is the only Gospel where Jesus isn't recorded as quoting Isaiah 56 verse 7, which says, "For my house will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples," along with Jeremiah chapter 7 verse 11, which says, "Has this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your sight?" It tells us instead in John 2 verse 16, he told those who were selling the doves, "Take these things out of here, stop making my father's house a marketplace." But that's a slight digression, but you're used to them. Next, or thirdly, if you're keeping track, because I'm a good Anglican this week, I've got 3 points. The placement of the story is very different in John's Gospel. In the other three, we call them the Synoptic Gospels because they share many of the same viewpoints. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this story follows on from the triumphant entry into Jerusalem, which we will mark on Palm Sunday in just a few weeks. Whereas in this Gospel, John's Gospel, as you may have noticed, these events are at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, following on from the wedding at Cana of Galilee, the first of Jesus' signs in the Gospel. It seems to be kind of obvious But John is choosing to place this at the start of Jesus' ministry. It's not meant to be a historical placement, but there are still biblical literalists who tie themselves in knots trying to explain how and why Jesus cleansed the temple twice, at the beginning and end of his ministry. But something tells me he probably wouldn't have got away with it twice. But in this gospel, this story is setting us up for what is to come. It's a reminder of the purity of intention that Jesus has, a reminder of the purpose that those who compiled John's gospel believed Jesus was going to live out. This seems to be the purpose, particularly or more obviously even, when we see the words in the conversation that follow this act of the cleansing of the temple. Firstly, the comment that the disciples remembered, "Zeal for your house will consume me," a very deliberate link to Psalm 69, which was linked by early Jesus movements to Jesus' crucifixion. That psalm, it talks about trying to quench thirst with vinegar, which we'll recognize from the Good Friday story. It then goes on in this passage to talk of the greatest sign in the Gospel of John, around which the Gospel is entirely constructed. The Gospel is just filled with signs, depending on which commentators you read, somewhere between 6 and 9 signs make up the Gospel of St. John. But the greatest one is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. John doesn't bother with spoiler alerts. From the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, it's laid out, this is what will happen. The cleansing of the temple, the conflict with the way that the temple is run, the way temple religion functions, the injustice within the courtyard, the bemusement of those who question Jesus. All of this is going to happen again and again in John's gospel, resulting in death and leading to resurrection. John's gospel wants to make all this clear from the very beginning. Even in the first chapter, when we have those beautiful verses, which we remember and we hear every Christmas, which talk of the Word being made flesh and dwelling among us, we read in verses 10 and 11 of that passage in chapter 1 of John, "He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own," or in another translation, "his own home, and his own people did not accept him." All of these stories are setting us up that we might understand the purpose and the meaning of the gospel, of Jesus' message. And, as the gospel writers say towards the end of John's gospel, "But these are written that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and through believing you may have life in his name." This gospel is not, I believe, trying to encourage us to righteous anger. It is showing us a Jesus who is pure of intent, devoted to the true faith of Israel, and setting about his ministry with prophetic zeal. And I want to end with something which we talked about at great length at Sermon Circle on Wednesday, the issue of anger for us as Christians. Of course we get angry. It's part of being human. It's part of going to parish councils. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. We are not religious robots who do not feel. We go through all the things that everyone goes through. Loss, hurt, happiness, heartbreak. Of course we feel what everyone feels, and we should. But it is what we do with our anger that is the mark of whether we feel angry or whether we become angry people. People who allow ourselves to be controlled by our anger, consumed by our feelings. Both the writer of Psalm 4 and Paul in Ephesians chapter 4 say these words, "Be angry," that's okay then, "but do not sin." Meaning, I think, do not allow your anger to break your relationship with others, to break your relationship with the divine, or break your relationship within yourself. For sin is ultimately that which is broken and needs healing. There's an impression that some have of those of us in the church being somewhat unreal, detached from the world, divorced from the normal stuff of life, somehow unaffected by what happens around us. And of course, this is not true. Anger is a part, an integral part of human nature. So is love. So is joy. So is sadness. So Jesus in this story breaks from that inadequate, gentle Jesus, meek and mild mold that we have forced him into and challenges us to consider what made this happen. As Christians, we've become afraid of conflict because it's so difficult to handle. We've become awfully nice people, but perhaps we have persuaded ourselves and others that polite niceness is Christianity. Whereas faith and love are not soft concepts. They are hard-edged, powerful, and even threatening. Christian faith is a faith that speaks out against and indeed should be angry at injustice, poverty, oppression, and exclusion. It is a faith that should side with the powerless against the powerful, a faith that demands action. And the love which we as Christians are called to exhibit and live by is not a soppy and romantic vision of love, but of a love which is bound up in a deep commitment to justice and equity. There are times when that love and that faith will cause us to resist wrongdoing, to act with strength and conviction, to follow that strong Christian tradition which speaks of God's refusal to stand by when injustice is perpetrated. We are called to a passionate faith, a faith that is tied up with all it means to be human. Anger, hope, fear, love, and all the messy emotions of life. Jesus himself felt these things, from weeping at the fate of Jerusalem and at the death of his friend, to the joy of friendship and of sharing God's life and love. We too, like Christ, are called to live lives filled with love and passion and with the zeal for God which made him and us powerful and world-changing. Thanks be to God. Amen.